still rockin' after all these years.
This is the story of my rock and roll butler.
This is it, the show that started it all. Often imitated, but never equaled. From San Francisco, USA. Online since 2004. Right. It's the one and only Rock and Roll Geek Show. With the original Rock and Roll Geek, Michael Butler.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Geek Show. My name's Michael Butler. Thanks a lot for joining me. I really appreciate it. Today is Wednesday, June 3rd, 2020, and it's 7:09 p.m. when I'm recording this intro. I just got off the phone with a guy named Kurt Davis. He used to be in a band called Bullet La Volta, and his stage name was Yucky Gipe. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Bullet La Volta, but they were a Boston band. Came out around, well, they were on Tang Records, which had a shitload of Boston hardcore bands like Gangrene, the FUs, Straw Dogs, just a whole bunch of bands. And Bullet La Volta was around that same time. And I have two of their albums, The Gift and Swan Dive. Both of those albums are absolutely amazing punk rock slash hard rock albums. And I was coming back from hunting mushrooms last week with my wife up in the mountains in Trinity County. And on the way back, we were listening to Swan Dive. And I told him this story. But I put it on, and man, that album held up so well. I don't know if you've heard this band before, but they're not together anymore, but those two albums are two of my favorite albums of all time. So I decided I was going to try to track down the singer from Bullet La Volta, and it was not easy, but I managed to track him down, and he agreed to come on. I had to do some convincing, but he finally agreed to come on. And you've never heard of this guy, but hopefully you will be a fan after this interview. The interview goes almost an hour, and I'm going to play a Bullet La Volta song from The Gift, and then we're going to go into the interview. Hope you enjoy it, friends. Kurt Davis, a.k.a. Yucky Gipe from Bullet La Volta. I'm going to play a song from The Gift. This song is called, I'll play Over the Shoulder, and then we'll go into the Kurt Davis interview. Thank you for listening, friends. You know where to find me, rockandrollgeek.com, rockandrollgeek@gmail.com. I will come back and say some parting words and play a tune after this interview. Here is Over the Shoulder.
Thought you knew, but you didn't. Thought you could escape. Now it's too late. Looks you right in the face. We'll be right back.
Hey, Kurt, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
Thanks a lot for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's no problem, man.
I will try to make it as painless as possible. I'm a little bit introverted, and sometimes I'll ask stupid questions, so I apologize if I ask anything really stupid.
Don't apologize. Likewise, I'm sure that I'll have plenty of things to apologize for as well. So there you go.
So you go by Kurt Davis? Is that what your name is?
Yeah, that's my name. I mean, yeah, I went by Yucky Guy for years. It was sort of, that was my punk rock name.
Yeah.
Came up with all my friends during the Sid Vicious and Johnny Rotten years, you know.
So what does Yucky Guy mean?
It doesn't mean anything. You know, it was sort of like, I guess, you know, just sounded good to me at the time. Uh-huh. And me and my friends, when we were kicking around and trying to like sort of come up with like alter egos, we all sort of came up with names for each other. And mine was Yucky Guy. I had a friend named Johnny Quest, and another one named Lumpy. And, you know, I don't know. We just all had names. So
I saw an interview. You were extremely difficult to track down. I want you to know that.
Well, I don't have any Facebook presence, you know, so I suppose that makes everything more difficult. But
I was listening. I just decided I was up mushroom hunting up in the mountains. And while I was up mushroom hunting, I said, you know, I'd really like to hear Swan Dive again. And I said, man, I haven't listened to that album in quite a while. And I put it on, and my wife was in the car. That is one of her favorite albums of all time. And we were both.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And when I was listening to it, I said, man, I got to get in touch with that singer, because this vocals on this album are so fucking great. And she started talking about all the lyrics, how they were so great. And so I started looking for, how am I going to find this guy? And I started Googling Yucky Guy, and nothing came up. And eventually I called a singer, my old singer who used to live in Boston. And a friend of his named Al, found out how to get in contact with you. Do you know a guy named Al? Al Quint?
Oh, yeah, Al. Yeah, I know Al.
Right,
yeah.
So if you don't.
Remember my voice, yeah.
If this interview ends up sucking, you can blame him for getting me in touch with him.
Yeah, so, you know, I don't have any sort of I don't have any expectations, so there's no baseline, so don't worry about it.
Okay, so yeah, and we were listening to that album on the way back from the mushroom hunting, and it was like a 10-mile hike, and then we started listening. Every single song on this Swan Dive album are fantastic. I love the Gift too. But Swan Dive, to me, like I told you when I emailed you, it's a masterpiece, and my wife thinks so too. Did girls like Bullet La Volta?
I don't know. I mean, my wife loved it. You know, she liked the band, she liked the music. But you know, at the time that it was happening, there was a lot of energy going on around the Boston scene. So. You know, there was a lot of stuff happening, and so it was a really exciting time. And you know, of course, like, you know, we were kind of right in the middle of it. And La Volta took off in a way that you know, it's kind of like, I don't know, it's weird. I didn't know any of those guys when I joined the band. I answered a flyer, and so it's sort of like, you know, and I was new in town. I was new to Boston. I moved there in '86, and I answered the flyer at age.
Remember what the flyer said?
You know, it said looking for a punk rock vocalist, and it listed some of the influences, and the influences were, they were a bunch of radio DJs on a local radio, Harvard radio station, WHRB. And so they listed things like Motorhead and AC/DC, and one of the things they mentioned was the Zero Boys. And I had done the album
from Indianapolis.
Yeah. And I'm from Indiana. My wife and I are both from Indiana. So when I saw the Zero Boys on there, and then it said something about Raw Power, and I asked them, I said, do you mean Raw Power the album or Raw Power the Italian hardcore band?
Yeah.
They were like, oh, this guy's cool, man. So
so you knew. You had a little bit of knowledge.
So, Yeah. And so, you know, I just answered a flyer. And I had been a drummer before that in an Indiana hardcore band called The Repellents.
Uh-huh.
And I had never sang before, but I had been writing words and lyrics and stuff like that. So I had like a notebook full of things. And so I decided to try out to be a singer. And I had no experience or anything. I just called them up. And our influences sort of meshed. And I went, and they already had, I guess when they auditioned me, they already had about 10 or 11 songs, you know, written. And so I already had a bunch of lyrics. So I sort of took those lyrics and fit them to the songs that those guys already had. And I guess they liked it. So it worked out okay. And things, anyway, I didn't know them. They didn't know me. I just sort of strapped myself in, and then we just took a ride together. You know, it was weird. I just shot out, and things happened pretty quickly, and the band took off pretty quickly and started getting big around Boston.
So you, when you auditioned, you sang like you sang on The Gift and Swan Dive, just the total anger and...
Yeah, so. Yeah, right. And, you know, probably like more like the first EP, I would say, was a very good indication of what it sounded like. You know, the first EP that's got like Baggage and Dead Wrong and those kind of songs on it.
So when that first EP was that, that was not on Tang Records, was it? The first EP was out on Tang Records?
Yeah, that was on Tang, and so was The Gift came out on Tang.
Yeah. And on Tang, there was Gangrene was the big band and was kind of like the big punk rock band in New York, I'm guessing. Gangrene, Stranglehold, FUs.
In Boston. Yeah, not in New York.
I'm in Boston, sorry. Gangrene, FUs. Tang was like the only punk rock label up there, weren't they? I remember this album.
It was a...
Sorry, you remember that album, This Is Boston, Not L.A.?
Yeah.
That kind of started the entire...
That was on Exclaim. I think that was like... I think that might have been SSD's label. I don't know who actually put that out.
Yeah.
But it was like on Exclaim Records. And that was, you know, I wasn't in Boston for the Boston hardcore scene. So when La Volta was coming up, it was like a little bit after that scene. And we came up about the same time as the Lemonheads were starting out.
Yeah.
They were younger than we were, but... same time.
Because Bullet La Volta is a little bit different than all those hardcore bands that were on Tang Records. I guess the Lemonheads were too. I'm not an authority.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we were definitely different.
What did that scene there embrace you guys from the start?
Well, I think so. Sort of. I mean, I think it was in the transitional period. I mean, I don't know how much you know about the history of the Boston hardcore scene. To me, it's only become apparent like over time because I wasn't here at that time. But what happened, and I think that the Boston hardcore scene was sort of a microcosm for what happened around the country, where a lot of the bands that started out were pretty primitive and, you know, thrashy and hardcore, and then they sort of started evolving a little bit more to more of like a metal sound. And I know that happened with SSD, you know, in particular, went in a more metal-y direction. And I think that was in the FUs and went into, you know, Straw Dogs, which is a more metal-y kind of direction.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that was sort of happening around the country. I think a lot of the bands that started out as hardcore bands started getting more metal-y, you know, in that way.
Yeah.
When La Volta was happening, we were sort of post that metal experience, you know, that changeover, but the guys that formed the band before I joined, we sort of took those hard rock influences, but we didn't, honestly, you know, everybody in La Volta was from different areas of the country. None of them were from Boston. So, I think we tapped into the same energy in a way, but weren't really a part of it, you know? So were we embraced? I think we were, because I think we were sort of a natural progression.
Yeah, because it was starting to cross over into metal.
I think we were sort of a natural progression from the way things were going in a way, but not necessarily. We weren't trying to predict anything, or it wasn't anticipated. It was just what we did at the time. And honestly, when I joined the band, I felt like they were a little more heavy metal. I was more of a punk rock kid. You know, I came more from a hard rock background. I thought they were a little more metallic than I was sort of into, but whatever. It was like, you know, hey, this seems like a good thing to do at the time.
Yeah. Where in Indiana did you grow up?
I grew up in a place called Anderson, which is about 30 miles north of Indianapolis. Right.
I lived in Broad Ripple for a short period of time, for about a year.
Oh, really? Well, that's, you know, I spent a lot of my formative time there. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
When were you there?
This was about maybe 86, 87, something like that, maybe 85, mid-80s.
Around the time I left.
Yeah, there was a guy named Bill Levin who was our manager.
Yeah, Bill Levin. I used to live at his house.
Oh, so did we. He was our manager. He ran this club called Muggins.
Yeah.
And he employed our entire band. And I was a cook at Muggins. And we didn't have any money or anything. So the band would come to the back door and I would cook, you know, make everybody everything that was in the refrigerator. And... And he would let us play at Muggins all the time. Bill Levin, I think that guy's... I think he's still around, too.
Yeah, he is. He's like a big marijuana advocate now.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. He's a normal guy.
Yeah, he's an impresario, man. Bill Levin, I lived with Bill Levin for a little while in Broad Ripple.
Yeah,
that's... With Johnny Quest.
Yeah.
Yeah, Bill Levin managed the Zero Boys for a while, and then he had a shop called Carfax Market.
That's right. Yep.
And my friend Johnny Quest ran Carfax Market with Bill and worked there and recorded, you know, and Johnny was in a band with Paul from the Zero Boys.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Paul Mahern, is that his name?
Yeah, Paul Mahern, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. We strolled into town on... had no money and an empty tank of gas, and we knew Tufty from Zero Boys, and he brought us to... This is not about Volta, but just anyway, he brought us to a grocery store and bought a bunch of taco meat and stuff, and introduced us to Bill Levin. And Bill Levin was doing a show at one of those clubs in Broad Ripple, but there were so many shows going on at Broad Ripple, and we played the show, and then immediately after the show, he wanted to manage us, and next thing we know, we were living at Bill Levin's house for the next year. It was good times.
So you and I might have lived in the same house.
Probably so. We destroyed his bathroom. We had a fat drummer who decided to put naked pictures all over the bathroom wall, and he decided to use the sink as a ladder and busted the sink off the wall, and I think we ruined Bill Levin's life.
I think that he probably doesn't even remember that, because he's probably had so many incidences.
Probably so. So when did you move to Boston? Did you move to Boston to go to college or something?
No, not at all.
You were chasing the punk rock?
Yeah, kind of. That's kind of what it was. My wife and I now was my girlfriend then. We lived together, and when she graduated from college, she didn't want to get a job there.
Oh, she was going to college. She was going to college in Boston.
She was going to college in Indiana.
Oh, okay.
And we met there, and we lived together for the last year that she was in college. And then when she graduated, she didn't want to get a job in Indiana because we'd be stuck there. And, I wasn't playing in a band at that point. So we just kind of decided where to go. So we moved together with everything we owned, went to Boston. We chose Boston because,
it was a good scene, good music scene.
Yeah. But it also had the nation's lowest unemployment rate.
Oh,
so
okay.
we knew we could get jobs. So we packed up everything we had into a U-Haul and drove to Boston. We didn't know anybody.
What job did you get?
I started working in a copy center in Harvard Square. Uh-huh. And two doors down from me was a record store. And the record store was where I saw the flyer for those guys looking for a singer.
And working in a copy center is a good job for a musician, because you can print out flyers.
Yeah, but I wasn't even a musician at that point. I was just a fucking schlub, you know?
So after you joined Bullet La Volta, did you still continue to work in the coffee shop, or excuse me, in the coffee center?
Yeah. We worked in the coffee place for a long time. In fact, the guy that gave me my job at the coffee place let La Volta practice in his basement for free for a couple of years. And it was very, it was really important to our development that we had a place to practice, and there were no other bands around or anything like that. And he didn't charge us rent or anything. He was great. Really nice guy.
So the band had member changes. Kenny Chambers came into the band. When did he come in?
Well, the band originally formed with, like I said, a bunch of Harvard DJs. And one of those Harvard DJs' name was Corey Lou Brennan. And he was the original lead guitar player. But he had a very strict academic path.
Was he trying to be a lawyer or something?
No. He became a teacher. He's a professor.
Harvard professor.
No. He went to Harvard, but he became a professor. He taught at Bryn Mawr, and then I'm not sure where else he went after that. But anyway, they were all Harvard students at the time, and he was one of the punk rock DJs there at the college radio station. So when they formed, then Corey was there, but he was on a pretty strict academic path. And the band started sort of taking off, and he had other things he needed to do. And Ken Chambers was coming to some of the early La Volta gigs, and the Moving Targets, his band, had broken up. So when that slot came open, he wanted to try out. And I actually don't think we auditioned anybody else because he knew all the songs. So we already recorded some stuff. So when he came in to try out, he already knew our set pretty much. And he nailed it. And so we took him on.
That guy is a ripping guitar player.
Yeah, he's awesome. And he's a great song too.
Yeah.
I think that it's one of those kind of like, you hear about this a lot, right? You know, where there's like too many strong personalities in certain bands, you know? Right. And it wasn't his, I think that him joining the band was sort of, you know, he wasn't the main songwriter in the band. So him being the side guitar player was good for him for a while. And eventually I think that he just got restless because it wasn't his band, you know? And being a side guy,
right,
didn't appeal to him. He still wanted to continue to write songs and play songs and stuff like that. So I think that, you know, things got disrupted a little bit. So he decided to leave. And
he was on Swan Dive though, wasn't he?
No.
Oh, he was not on Swan Dive. Oh.
No, that's Duke Roth. Duke Roth played guitar on Swan Dive. Duke was great. He was another guy that was like a local Boston dude. He played in a band called King Moonraiser that was really fucking awesome.
Yeah.
And Duke was a really strong songwriter and a really strong singer, actually. Duke is an excellent singer and a really strong songwriter and a fucking amazing guitar player. And I mean, the guy was fucking unbelievable guitar player.
The guitar parts on Swan Dive, they're like up there with Joe Perry. They are like... so tasteful, these solos. Did he do all the solos on that album?
No, he and Clay traded off. Clay's also an excellent guitar player. He played in Chavez for years. I don't know if you
know that band. Chavez. Which one did the most melodic solos? Because you had one of the guys was doing a little bit more shredding, and the other guy was doing more the melodic Joe Perry style solos.
I don't really know what you mean by that, so I'd have to like sit there with you with the record and say, this is him and this is him, and sort of break it down.
I'm going to be doing an episode on, I might include this in that episode, but I probably will separate them, but I'm going to do an episode and I'm going to break down every track and I'm going to geek out on that album, try to turn people onto that album, because most of the people I know have never even heard of Bullet La Volta. Because I'm out here in California now.
Yeah, I mean, we did tour a lot, and we played a lot. And we were one of those sort of also-ran bands, you know, that we're one of the thousands of bands that were around. And
I saw you guys at the place at this place called the Covered Wagon Saloon in San Francisco, California.
It was, yeah, I remember that place.
We lived upstairs from this was the same band that was managed by Bill Levin. We moved to San Francisco, and we lived up. There was like this flophouse hotel above the Covered Wagon. And we lived up there, and they had shows at the Covered Wagon every single night of the week. And we would go, you know, we got in free because we lived at the Covered Wagon. So I remember seeing you guys. I think you had just, the record had just come out on a major label. And I remember you telling everybody, I don't remember if the crowd loved it or not. I loved it because I was already a Bullet La Volta fan. And I remember you telling the crowd, you know, I know this is on a major label. You're almost being apologetic that it was on a major label, and said, just steal it. We don't care how you get it. Just, you know, and,
yeah, that sounds about right. yeah, it was weird, right? You know, being on a major label is a weird thing, you know?
So were major labels like, just signing bands like crazy in Boston at that time? Is that how you got on a major, or were you just so huge? How did that happen?
Well, it felt very organic, you know. When we started out, we put out some radio tapes, and those got a lot of airplay locally, and then we started playing shows, and the shows started getting bigger, we started getting more popular, we started, you know, it just felt organic. We just started getting bigger, and we'd play in New York, and things were well there, and of course, that was, like, at the height, when, like, CMJ festival and all that shit was going down. Yeah. And you know, there were a lot of like conferences and conventions shit. And before South by Southwest.
Right. Yes. We'll see.
So, you know, there were a lot of bands coming up and about at that point, and we were just one of the thousands of them. And, you know, it just felt organic. We were just one of those bands that we went to Europe with the Lemonheads and developed our following there. We were road tested. We were pretty, you know, we were hungry. We were trying to kill it. You know, we were trying to take over the fucking world or whatever, and trying to fucking destroy everybody in our path or whatever. Yeah. And trying to be as ambitious as possible with what, you know, like I said, you just sort of hitch a ride and see where it goes, right? So it just felt like that. So people were sort of sniffing around, labels were sniffing around for bands at that time, and we were one of the bands, and RCA was one of the labels, and whatever, you know.
I'm always curious when the major label meets the you know, the up and coming punk rock or indie band or whatever that was always on a smaller label. How's that? Do you remember the major label meeting?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, it was really interesting, you know, at the time was, so, I mean, it's all this weird comedy of errors in a way, because the guy that saw us and was really enamored with us and signed us eventually was an A&R guy named Bob Fiden, and he was the guy that signed Patti Smith to Arista, and so he was
kind of a pioneer.
Yeah, he was just a really cool dude, you know, that had his ear to the ground, you know, and he had like legitimacy in his veins, and he knew kind of what was going on. And at that time, the head of RCA, the president of RCA, is this guy named Bob Buziak. And Bob Buziak had cut his teeth in Detroit when the Stooges and MC5 were coming up. So he understood us intrinsically from the get-go.
Right.
So those were the guys that courted us. Those were the guys that signed us. And by the time Swan Dive came out, unfortunately,
I know the story, but go ahead. It's the typical story, so, but go ahead.
Yeah, it is the typical story. So Bob Buziak was replaced, and the guy that was in there was the head of RCA Country Division and didn't know anything about us. They didn't really have... They didn't have the vision. Once the record came out, it was a different team than the team that signed us. You know,
yeah,
really, that's what happened.
You're kind of lucky the record even came out, because a lot of those stories when a band gets signed and, you know, they'll change hands and they'll just shelf the record and the band will be forced to break up.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, you know, they did. They had invested a certain amount of money in us and a certain amount of time and, you know, whatever, put us. They didn't really, by the time the record came out, they didn't really know what to do with us, yeah. Honestly. I mean, that's honestly, they didn't really know how to market it. They didn't know if they wanted to throw their money or weight behind us, you know?
Did they give you any tour support to start?
Well, none.
None. Okay, well, that can be a good thing in a way.
Well, it wasn't enough. I mean, the weird thing was we did a tour with Prong and COC, uh-huh. Right? And so we went all across the country with them. We did a tour with Soundgarden.
Yeah.
And all these, it seems to me, like, in hindsight, and at the time, we were a little disheartened with showing up to the venues and, you know, the posters that are on the wall.
Right.
We've both had these black and white posters that are kind of shitty. And COC and Prong have these full color posters and stuff like that. We didn't feel the support behind us, although there was a little bit, you know. They did put money up to put us on the road. And it wasn't a lot. They weren't fully invested, you know, so they were sort of like, I think it's weird that the bands that ended up being successful at that period of time were the ones that, like, in particular, like Soundgarden is a great example, not musically, but just like their label allowed them to develop over time.
Right.
And they invested in that band. Their resources, right? So I think when it came to La Volta, that RCA didn't really know how to apply their resources to what we were trying to do. They didn't get it, you know. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
How long before RCA dropped the band?
Well, we broke up.
Oh, you broke up. Okay.
Yeah, we broke up.
Because you were disillusioned from the record and all that?
Well, no, there were a lot of factors about that. I have to primarily take the hit for that because I had a 2-year-old son, and so going on the road was really tough, just on my wife and on me to be away from him.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you know, not getting the support from the label, any sort of minor conflicts that are going on in the band end up being magnified in that particular situation. And the way for us to make money was to stay on the road, and to be on the road for 6 weeks away from my 2-year-old son, who at that point is cognizant of the fact that his dad's not there.
Yeah.
When I'm talking on the phone or whatever. And, the 6-week tour is over, and all of a sudden you have a proposal for another, you know, 6-week tour with only a week in between. It's like, you know, I had to make some decisions, and my decisions were to stay with my family.
And there was probably not enough money to send home to the wife to pay the bills, right?
That's exactly right. It would have been a different story if I'd been able to support the family and I was out, but I wasn't. I wasn't able to do that. I wasn't making any money. And the only way to make money was to be on the road, and then I'm away. And the only way we're making money anyway was selling tour merch, really. And it was like T-shirts and posters and CDs or whatever. But the label wasn't behind it, so it was a confluence of a lot of different factors. You know, there was a lot of stuff going on. It was like there were strains within the band, and there was the label not supporting us, and then there was the pull of my family at home that just made it. You know, it wasn't worth it, really. You know, is what it ultimately came to. That was my decision. Was it wasn't worth it to be away from my family to put myself out there like that. And I wasn't looking for. I think if the label had been more behind it, it might have changed the paradigm a little bit. I don't know.
You think if you guys wouldn't have signed to a major label, maybe the band would have stayed together longer?
I don't know. I mean, I think we lived our natural life.
Yeah.
I don't know.
That Gift album, was that produced by a guy named Tom Hamilton?
No, Tom Hamilton was the guy that did the first EP.
Okay.
And then the Gift was actually produced by a guy named Paul Coldery. And Paul Coldery went on to engineer some Radiohead stuff.
So Tom Hamilton, even though he's from Boston, is not the same.
No, it wasn't Tom Hamilton from here.
Yes. Because when I was a kid, that's how I don't know how I got that, but we were all, oh yeah, these guys are produced by the bass player from Aerosmith, because we just said Tom Hamilton on it. We didn't know any. And the band kind of reminds me kind of like a cross between Keith Morris era Black Flag and Aerosmith. So it was kind of, you would, I don't know where I'm going
all
with
right,
that, but
yeah, sure, why not?
Yeah. So are you living in Indianapolis now? You're back in Indianapolis?
Oh no. We live in Boston.
Oh, you live in Boston. Okay. All right. Good. So you like Boston. So everything worked out great in Boston.
Boston is home. I've got two sons. They're in bands as well.
Huh. What kind of bands are they in?
They're in sort of like pop punk emo kind of bands.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
Is called Blame It on Whitman. And the other one, Whitman is a place in Massachusetts, so they practice there. So they call it Blame It on Whitman. And the other one is called Dance with Leland, which Dance with Leland has both of my sons in it.
Huh.
One is the drummer, the other is guitar player, and they both sing. And then Blame It on Whitman is my son plays guitar and sings in that band.
What do they think of your old band's music, Bullet La Volta music? I know you had another band, the Conks, but what do they think of Bullet La Volta?
I think they like it.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. They don't go on and on about it, but, I think they appreciate it, you know?
Didn't you guys do a reunion like, not too long ago? It was like some kind of Boston thing.
Yeah. It wasn't exactly a reunion for La Volta. I mean, it sort of was, I mean, a little bit. So Ken Chambers was in town doing like he put a new version of the Moving Targets together, and they played a show in Boston with a bunch of other Boston bands that were getting together to do a reunion. And so we put together a La Volta set, and with Ken, and then our original drummer, Chris Guttmacher, who plays on the first EP and on The Gift, came up and played a few songs with us on that. And my son Max played guitar on a couple of songs as well. So it was pretty cool.
Now, were you the vocals on that Swan Dive album and on The Gift too? Angry as hell. I mean, they were like extremely angry. Were you really pissed off, or you just thought it was like a punk rock thing to sound angry like that? Because it sounded really, really, and particularly the song. Before I Fall, there's like some angry stuff. And what's the song where you go, I can't think of it. Maybe it's maybe Drag. When Bad News Travels Fast. What is that song? Not to Mention, Oh My God.
Yeah, that's Drag.
Yeah. Really, really pissed off. Were you pissed off?
Yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
Good.
I always have been.
Good.
I mean,
are you still pissed off now?
Yes, I am.
Good.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad to hear that.
But you know, it takes different forms. I'm also happy. You know, it's weird. It's a weird convolution.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt, but a lot of people who get their anger out by screaming on stage, tend to be more well-adjusted. If you know what I mean, they tend to get
compared to politicians.
Well, they don't hold it. They don't hold it in. They release their anger on stage by yelling and screaming, and they don't hold it in and go home and beat their wife.
I get you. Okay, sure. I think that's kind of true. It's like, it was a really good way to release it, for sure. You know, I don't have that catharsis now because I don't really sing in a band like that, but you know, I don't know, at the time I don't really consider myself to be the same person that I was then.
Yeah, we all
grow up. Changed a lot. Yeah, we all change and we all grow and whatever, and But I mean, at the same time, it's like, you know, I mean, I think if you listen to, if particularly, I mean, your wife, I don't know, I mean, she sounds like she knows the lyrics of that album, but, you know, I mean, what you hear in that album is there's some pretty clear-cut cries for help on that album. It's like,
yeah,
I think in general, the way that my approach to music in particular, but life in general, has to do with this sort of, like, music has always been my escape. Even when I was like a misunderstood teenager before I was ever in a band or anything, music has always been this sort of a world for me to escape into, to sort of leave the present world that I'm in and sort of go into this sort of place where regular rules don't apply. Regular life doesn't apply. It's an escape for me, right? It's like this world that's created by and for reckless abandon, and just sort of like, it's a place for pure expression and anger and vitality and all those things to sort of exist in that space, right? And those kind of things are not condoned in your regular life,
right?
At work or whatever. So you have this sort of escape hatch,
an outlet.
Right?
And, it's an outlet.
And music was always that for me. So if you listen to Swan Dive in particular, or The Gifts, or Bullet of Volta in general, whatever it is, I think it's pretty clear that I was trying to remove myself from the quote-unquote regular fucking world, you know?
Yeah.
Because that doesn't really hold my reality. My reality exists outside of the reality that most people consider to be normal. You know, my reality has to exist outside of that, and for me to function as a human being. And that just means that, that doesn't mean that I don't address reality on the ground. That just means that I have a different way of being able to vent those feelings and those frustrations and that anger. And I have a place to put it where it's acceptable, not just acceptable, but expected, right?
In that song, Ceiling Life, it breaks down into a real, like, you know, almost mellow and melodic, pretty part, you know, and the breakdown part, and you say, she was a brown skinned woman. She had dark wavy hair.
She had black wavy hair. Yeah.
Was that your wife?
No, actually I took that line from a Lead Belly song.
Ah, okay. All right.
So at the time that La Volta was on the road, we used to listen to this Lead Belly tape over and over again. And there's a Lead Belly song where she, you know, she was a brown skinned woman. She had black wavy hair. And I think that with Ceiling Life, the actual verse part before it goes into the breakdown part, the verse part is an exposition of the ideal of the sort of like I base it on the idea of like Woodstock or like a hippie festival, right?
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. So you're at this festival. It's basically Ceiling Life is sort of like means living your life upside down, and everything is flipped over, right? So it's a concept, and that Ceiling Life means that your feet are not on the floor. Your feet are on the ceiling.
Right.
And you're upside down and you're hanging, and everybody else in the world is on the ground, and you're living above them, right? So Ceiling Life means you're living above everybody, and you're sort of looking down at everything happening, sort of like a trip or an LSD experience or a psychic experience or a mind expanding experience. That it's a total train of thought song. The way that I wrote that song is so funny, because I just wrote down the sort of like the most ridiculous ideas of, in mind that, that somebody's at like a rock festival in a tent, living in a tent. And then at the end of it, when it breaks down, it's sort of like these idealized concepts of everything. You're living upside down and all of a sudden you're in that world, right? So when it flips over, that's your ceiling life. And you're going in like, you know, she was a brown skinned woman. And it's like she's drifting away and you're like trying to hang on to something. And, you know, she had black wavy hair. It's like these sort of like concepts of just an ideal of something, right? And, but it has to, it's not a specific thing. It's a thought. It's a feeling. It's intangible, honestly. You know, it's something that you're trying to hold on to that doesn't exist and or something.
And the chorus, don't take me from the ceiling. That means you want to,
you want to stay there, right?
Yeah.
You want to be, you want to live in that world. You want to escape forever. You don't want to come back down, right? So, you know, it's funny. Like, there's one line of that song where I say, purple straw shut from the south. I mean, I don't know if you know the lyrics to that song because they're not, it's all very convoluted, but there's one thing where I say purple straw shot from the south. Your wife would probably get a kick out of this if she knows the lyrics, because the purple straw shot from the south is just a fart.
Oh, okay. How is a purple straw shot from the south? Is that a Boston lingo for a fart?
No, I just made it up.
Oh, okay. The lyrics on this on that album are really well thought out. And, you know, I was talking about the drag. What's the problem? Oh, my God. And then when you say, I'm awfully glad you asked, that sets the song completely where it should be. You know, what's the problem? Oh, my God. And then you say, I'm awfully glad you asked. And then, you know, it's really fucking angry as hell and really cathartic for me to listen to.
Man, well, whatever you get from that, yeah. You know, it's good.
Are you happy with all those Bullet La Volta records?
Am I happy with them?
I mean,
them?
Do you like all three of those things? The Matador was pretty much a compilation, right?
What's that?
When the last record that was on Matador, that was pretty much a compilation, right? Didn't Matador Records put out a Bullet La Volta?
No, that wasn't a compilation. No, that was a live set that we played on the
it was
radio.
Live.
When we were first starting out.
Okay. Oh, that was good. Because I thought that came out after Swan Dive.
Well, it came out on Matador after Swan Dive, but it was recorded in 87.
Okay. That makes sense. That makes
when the
sense.
Band was pretty early.
I don't know what my question is. Anything you would have done different about those records?
Well, you asked me if I'm happy with them.
Yeah. I mean, are you pleased with the way they came out?
Well, here's the thing, right? It's like you always look at things and say, like, I would have done this different. I might have done that. But I kind of don't go in for the whole, like, what if kind of thing.
Yeah,
I mean, I would say one, you know, I mean, there's certain things that bother me about certain things, you know, particularly on Swan Dive. I mean, we sort of allowed I hesitate to say it because I think that when I say something that bothers me, that might not bother somebody else, that then they're going to recognize it and they're going to carry that with them. Every time they hear it, they're going to go, I never thought of that, but now that I hear it, fuck. You know, so I hesitate to say it, but I mean, there's little things that sort of that bother me about it. But in general, I will say, you know, it is what it is. It happened when it happened, and it represents that thing that was going on with the band at the time. They're all sort of documents of that time and place, you know? So in that respect, yeah, I'm fine with it. You know, it is what it is. I cringe sometimes when I hear some of the fucking lyrics that I wrote. You know, honestly, it's like I said before, I don't feel like the same person that wrote those things, you know? So some of it comes off a little, you know, it sounds clunky. It sounds a little stupid sometimes, but whatever. It's, you know, I mean, I was a kid sometimes when I wrote that stuff, you know?
I should have phrased it was, are you proud of those, of all those records?
Well, yeah, to some degree, yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I am, I'm proud of them. They're, I think they hold up, you know, in general, like listening and rocking out. It's like fucking crank it up really loud and you feel a certain way. Yeah, they generate what we were intending. And
when is the last time
it was a kick-ass band. I mean, I'll just say that, you know, we were a fucking kick-ass band.
It really was.
When we played, we were out there to fucking
destroy.
We were out there to make, yeah, we were out there to destroy, but we're also there to try to make sure that we're not wasting our time. We want to take everybody with us on whatever trip we're fucking going on, right? You know, that's what I'm saying, you know?
Yeah.
You want everybody to be there with you when you're going wherever you're going and whatever you're doing, so. I want people to get swept up in that thing. And those songs were pretty fucking kick-ass, some of those songs.
And for what was, I guess, called punk rock at the time, extremely catchy tunes. I mean, there's so many sing-alongs, especially on the Gift, Dead Wrong, Police, Gift, and Between the Lines, super catchy as hell. And is like, I can go on and on kissing your ass about every song, but
well, I'm glad you like it. Really, you know, I mean, it's nice to have people that appreciate it.
When's the last time you listened to a Bullet La Volta song?
I hesitate because it hasn't been that long, but I don't remember when.
It's been a while.
Within the last year, you know, at some point.
Oh, okay. Are you still playing now?
No. Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no. I have some friends that I get together with, and we hang out and play music, like, once every few months, but since this fucking COVID pandemic has been going on, we haven't been getting together. So, but no, I'm not really playing in a band per se.
What do you do for a living?
Right now I'm not doing anything. I was looking for a job before the pandemic hit and, I have an Airbnb at my house.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, that's good. We're trying to get our house Airbnb ready, too. What does your wife do?
Yeah, we've had the Airbnb. We did it for about a year solid before all the shit hit, and it was going pretty good. So,
yeah, that puts a real damper in an Airbnb when you can't rent the damn thing out, man.
Yeah, for sure.
So you're still married to the same girl that you were with when you were when you moved from Indianapolis?
Yes.
Oh, how long?
My wife and I, we've been together for 34 years.
Yeah, now. I just celebrated my 30th anniversary. I
35 years. Long time. Yeah. We have two grown sons and, yeah, I don't know. She and I are both still totally solid.
That's good. How old are you?
I am 59.
59, you're about one year older than me. Well, Kurt, did they ever call you yucky? Did your kids ever call you yucky?
No.
Did they know you? Did they make fun of you?
They just call me Dad.
Did they ever make fun of you for the name Yucky Gipe?
Oh, no. Okay. No, of course not. They know better.
Yeah. All right.
When you name yourself Yucky Gipe, you know it's fucking ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's
like,
what are you going to say to me?
Yeah.
What are you going to say? Oh, hey. It's I mean, it's like, if you know the Conks at all, too, it's like, I mean, that was my musical identity. The Conks were together for 12 years. It's like, you know, everything is built to fucking be disastrous. I don't even care.
Yeah. Your other band, The Conks, you did a cover of an Aerosmith tune. You did Let the Music Do the Talking, right?
Yeah, we did the Joe Perry, Joe Perry Project.
No, you did Steven Tyler's version on vocals. You did the Steven Tyler vocal version.
Oh, really? I think we did the Joe Perry version.
What were the lyrics? Checkmate, baby, if you want to dance. Grab yourself a partner and take a chance. Is that the one you sang?
Ah, Fuck, I don't remember, man.
Yeah, that was the Aerosmith.
I'm gonna have to go back and compare.
Pretty sure it's the Aerosmith version, but pretty sure it's Steven Tyler's vocal melody. But anyway, it's a great version, and it's a coincidence because I have there's a group of listeners to this show that's a Facebook group, and somebody posted, "Hey, does anybody know where?" This is like a week ago. And somebody, does anybody know of anybody who's covered this, anybody else who's covered Let the Music Do a Talk? And all this guy put up was Joe Perry Project and the Aerosmith version. And I said, oh, funny you should say. Here's a version right here. And this guy was in a great band called Bullet La Volta. And yeah, I think it's Steven Tyler's version. But it doesn't, I don't even know what I asked you. But anyway, it's a great version. It's a great tune and a great version. So you're an Aerosmith, I guess everybody in Boston was an Aerosmith fan, right?
Well, you know, I was an Aerosmith fan well before I ever moved to Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
I saw Aerosmith in 1976.
So did I, on the Rocks
and
tour.
And 77, yeah. And they were in such bad fucking shape, they couldn't even play.
Yeah, yeah.
Joe Perry was falling into his amps, and he had roadies behind his amp just to fucking hold his amp up.
Yeah, I saw him.
But then I saw them again in either the early 2000s or the late 90s. No, it was the early 2000s, and they were fucking great.
Yeah, I saw them on the Rocks tour in like 76, 75, 70, I don't remember, I think 76. And then I saw them on the draw, I saw them a million times, but back when they were doing the Cal Jam days, and that's when they were really fucked up, they were in Draw the Line, and I remember Joe Perry just, they got up and played with Ted Nugent. You know, they did an encore with Ted Nugent, and Joe Perry was so fucked up. He picked up his guitar and then he played for like 1 second and then put it down and walked off the stage.
Yeah, they were a mess, man. That's what I try to tell people. They're like, Aerosmith must have been great. And I was like, man, I gotta tell you, I saw hundreds of rock shows and those guys were fucking shit.
Yeah, but somebody for a band that was so fucked up, they made some good records back then.
Yeah, they sure did. That's true.
All right, well, Kurt, I really thank you for doing this. It was really nice to talk to you, and I'm glad I got to find out what's going on with you now. You were kind
yeah,
of
no problem.
You were kind of always
thanks for reaching out.
You were kind of a mystery to me, and always wonder where this guy is. And so I'm glad I got to talk to you.
Yeah, it turns out it's not such a mystery after all.
Well, still, it's a good. I think it's a. I always like to hear the story, and I think it's a good one.
Yeah, well, thanks for reaching out. I appreciate it.
All right.
And I'm glad you think it's. I had to actually look up the definition of masterpiece after you wrote that to me, because I'm like, I'm not too sure about that.
Yeah, well, I think it's a great record. My wife loves it even twice as much as I do. So, and you know, if my wife likes a record like that, it must have something. She's not usually into that kind of music. She's more into, you know. I won't get into that, but she loves it. She's singing along to all. We were listening to it coming back from the mushroom hunt, and she was singing along to every line. So
wow.
That's saying something. If my wife likes it, it's saying something.
Well, that's cool. That's the way I feel about my wife too. So yeah, well, tell her I said thanks, and I tell her I hope that, you know, I hope it served her well all these years.
All right, Kurt. Well, thank you for doing this. Enjoy the rest of your night, and be safe out there, friend.
Okay, man.
Right.
Well, take care.
All
thanks.
Right. Talk to you
Bye.
Later. Bye.
All right.
There you go. Kurt Davis, a.k.a. Yucky Guy. I hope that was okay. I'm such a fan of Swan Dive. On either the episode before... I'm going to post this one tonight. And after this one, I'm going to be doing... I'm going to do a track-by-track of Swan Dive from top to bottom. It is a great fucking album. So I'm going to close out with the song we were talking about called Ceiling Life from the Swan Dive record. 6 minutes and 58 seconds. But man, it's 6 minutes and 58 seconds of pure joy for me, friend. So thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this. As I always say, it's a value for value. So if you got any value out of this, I ask you, please contribute what value it gave you. I would tell you to go to Kurt Davis's website and let him know you heard him on the Rock and Roll Geek Show. But you can't get in touch with this guy. I think he's on Instagram. I will post his Instagram link, and you can send him a message and let him know you heard him on the Rock and Roll Geek Show so he doesn't think he wasted 54 minutes and 33 seconds of his time. All right, friends, I will talk to you soon. Find the show at rockandrollgeek.com. Send me an email, rockandrollgeek@gmail.com. Here's Ceiling Life. I will talk to you probably in a couple of days. We'll do a regular Rock and Roll Geek Show, and we'll break down Swan Dive, the masterpiece that is Swan Dive. I'll talk to you later, friends.
It's a rock and roll geek train wreck.